You say there. We're recording. Welcome to the recorded version of this course. I'll jump back to the course webpage here. And well, on top of who we are and where to read about things, then there are two main things of this course. And that is a small project and a final project. And you might ask, why are we doing so many projects? Well, to some extent, this course is an umbrella over doing projects with machine learning in science. It doesn't even have to be science. It's mostly just trying to analyze data with machine learning. And that's why we have two projects. And the small project counts 40% of your grade, or points, and the final project counts 60%. And the small project is one where each and every one of you will have to submit answers. I'll get into what that constitutes. Whereas the final project is one to be done in groups and presented in general. For the small project, what you send in is just numerical solutions, and I'll get to what that constitutes. And just to let you know that if you hand in the small project and it fulfills the requirement and so on, then you will gain automatically about 75% points of what's available in the small project. This is simply to make sure that you all have algorithms running on your computer that you're in charge of, that you can get machine learning solutions out of. That's the purpose of that. The final project is one that you can define on whatever data you want to do. It has to be slightly substantial, slightly complex data, but from there on, you decide what you want to do. And at the very bottom, I've actually put the list of projects from last year, simply so that you can see what other people did. Now, before I dive into these two projects, let me just say that, in order for you may then ask, if the small project is an individual project, may I discuss it with others? And the answer is yes, we pray and beg that you do. Because you should, of course, submit your own solution developed by yourself. But especially in these times, what you will learn the most from is interacting with your peers. So you should already look at the list of people who are participating in this class and say, well, do I know anybody, are somebody my friends, are somebody within my field, my year, my anything, and team up. Because if you sit alone, then most likely you will run into problems at some point or conceptual things that you don't understand or that you might misunderstand, and discussing them with your peers is the way to do it. So for the same reason, we put up a Slack channel, and you should all have had an invitation by now. I'm going to stop sharing again so that I can see if people had an invitation or not. Did everybody see that invitation? Please vote yes or no. Well, again, I see quite a few yeses, so it has been sent out. For those who haven't gotten it, it's an invitation to Slack, which is a quite used platform for especially developing code, but essentially also, you know, whatever you want to discuss. But it's good for forming small groups. Do you have to use Slack? Not at all. You may use whatever you want to do, but here's just a suggestion and a forum. And some people are asking, where can you find the vote button? And for me, it is at the bottom of the list when you put up chat or participants in here. I'm going to go back to sharing the screen and back to the course. So, small project, let's dive into this. Here we try to describe it in as much detail as we could. So, well, what is it? Well, it's a project between now and the 18th of May. And you might say, can I start now? The answer is yes. You're more than welcome to start. Maybe there'll be some advantage in waiting, let's say, a week until you have at least established well, a little piece, some code for doing it, but and some of the methods. But if you're already confident in doing it, well, go on. So the data consists of a large number of particle collisions from CERN's LHC accelerator just outside of Geneva. And in particle physics, I'm going to stop sharing and try to explain. In particle physics, you collide protons, or at least you do at LHC at CERN. And if somehow an electron comes flying out, then you know something interesting happened, because there are no electrons inside protons, and hence a new particle must have been created which decayed to, among other things, an electron. So we're interested in identifying these electrons. And moreover, we want to know what energy it had. We also want to know the direction, but this is easy to measure. But the energy is obtained by saying, well, it hit the detector here, and from the size of the signal in many different bits and pieces, we can perhaps estimate the energy. So we want to do categorization, getting is it an electron or not? And for those who are electrons, we want to know what was your energy. And then finally, we want you to try to cluster the particles there in an unsupervised way. So not using the fact that in these files, at least in the training file, there is knowledge whether this was an electron or not and what energy it had, but also that you should try an unsupervised machine learning algorithm. And that's the purpose of it. All right, back to sharing so we can, so I can point and read. Okay, so so we split the data sample into a training sample and a testing sample. And the thing is that the training sample is what you should train on. And then afterwards, you should, whatever you got out of the training sample, you should apply it to the test sample, write out your results, and submit them to us. And we will have something that reads if your solution is valid and readable, and if so, well, you're done. And how many variables can you use? Well, I think there's 166 variables in this data set for each electron candidate. Well, you should, for the classification, only use 15 variables. For the energy regression, max use 10. Whereas for the clustering, you're welcome to use up to 25 variables. And not only should you submit your solution, you should also submit a variable, the variables that you used. We'll get a lot more back to this, but that is the, that's the problem. That's the small project. All right, then I will go back here. And well, then there's the final project. And the final project is written here. So the project description is, you may work on numbers, texts, images, anything. I specifically put question marks because, well, your imagination is the limit. The only strict requirement are that you use a machine learning algorithm on some sizable data and that you do it in a group. That's it. Yeah, and you should ideally be three or four persons, but write me if that is not possible. And then you might say, when does the final project start? Well, it to some extent starts today as well, meaning we're not going to do anything official about it. And if we go back to the calendar below, you will see that on the 13th of May, we're going to have sort of a kickoff session working on it. But there's nothing stopping you from starting now. And one of the things you might want to consider is, who may you want to work with? And that depends a little bit on perhaps what you want to work on. And, well, look around, see what you think would be interesting. We put up a list of things that you can work on here. And we put up initials just to know who to go to and ask. Well, here it is. Here is a compilation of experiences from last year's final projects. And the solution is simply one you submit as a presentation. And the presentation should have two parts, namely slides you wanted to present and the bonus slides. And in the bonus slides, that's where you put all your technical and hard work and the details of optimization and things like that. And on Wednesday, the 10th of June, all day, we will, perhaps in person, perhaps on Zoom, we'll see, have a frenzy with people presenting these and asking questions and so on, and also evaluating them. And yes, you will be part of evaluating them, not because your evaluation will be part of the grading, but simply part of this course is also the ability to see what other people have done with machine learning and evaluate. All right. I think I'll jump back here and say, well, stop sharing, and then ask, at the risk of this going berserk, are there any questions? And well, please write in the chat if you have questions, and start. Any questions this far? No? I highly doubt that it was this clear. All right, those who marked, please unmute and speak up. I see a question in writing, if there's any source code from GitHub. Not yet, but there will be. But generally, this is a course where we mostly provide data and explanations. So in the beginning, at the end of the week, we will give an example solution to today's exercise, you could call it, namely for this data set that's been posted with week one, which is on identifying B-quarks, but it doesn't matter what it is to some extent, we'll give example solutions for that. But no, there will not be any initial code for most of what we're doing. For some of the things, there will be. Yeah, did that answer that? Apparently so. Okay. How important is it that I have a microphone during the lecture? Not overly important, but it's probably a smart thing to have in general, and you might want to ask a question. Any other questions? You're also welcome to just unmute and speak. No? All right. Well, then I will go to the general course information.
Tolls, there were two new questions.
Ah, okay, yeah. How many people should we be in the project groups? 3 to 4. But last year there were 5 who came and said, we want to write a solution for the game called Bomberman. And they were fire and flames and knew how to divide it and so on. And I thought that was cool. And I think there was another group of, it was one group of 2 persons, which were on a very specific type project. But the problem is, if we're 50 57 students now. I don't know how that exploded from 39, but 57. Let's say that we're just, 56. Then that will constitute 14 groups. And if each of these present for 15 minutes, then it's 3 per hour, which means that without a break, we have 5 hours straight of presentation. Now, that is manageable, but not more than that, right? And that's if everybody is in a group with 4 persons. So I think 4 is a good number. 3 is acceptable, 5 is probably also acceptable. But if you're more than that, then it tends to be hard to combine. Okay. All right. And then there was a question, does chapter 5 in the book, and I assume that you mean Deep Learning by Ian Goodfellow, part 1. Yes. Cover absolutely everything that we'll learn in the course? And the answer is no, no, no. I think what we want to teach you in the course is not the hardcore math behind machine learning, but rather the intuition and the application. And the book will tend to put more math behind, but math is poorly taught in lectures. It's much better taught by reading a book. And that's why we put those references in there. There's also for algorithms, for example, how come LightGBM is so fast and what did XGBoost do to become faster? And, you know, I compare it to scikit-learn. Why? Well, actually, the XGBoost paper is quite readable. And so that's one of the reasons we refer to it. Okay. Is there a recommended approach for forming groups if you know nobody else in the course? Man, I love that question because I'm going to share my screen now and answer that question. I asked you to try to say, to fill out a questionnaire. And the questionnaire was on, you know, who are you, but also where are you from? Do you speak Danish? How many years did you study for? What's your direction of field? What operating system do you have? And possibly a photo. And that is summarized here for 36 persons that had filled it out this morning. And I'd love the last 20 to also fill it out. But here, please sit and study this and ask yourself, look, who could I, do I know anybody here? Who could I potentially collaborate with? And simply write them a mail. And I would love you to also, when you have formed a group, which are even 10% chance that you might do a project for the final project, write me. Because I'm going to write out to all of those who are not in groups and try to form groups. And that is because it is known and very well studied that what you learn most from is interacting with peers. Interact with your fellow students. And by doing so, well, that's where you learn the most. We can tell you things, and that's, of course, useful, but we're nowhere as good at making you understand and know things than discussion with your peers are. And then you can return with questions. And I think it also goes to say now that you're welcome to write us emails with questions at all times. I know I will get more emails in this course and the rest of us than in other courses, but that's circumstances. So that's fine. Yeah. So here's the who is who or who are you and where can you find that? I'm going to stop sharing that and start sharing the course webpage, which disappeared somewhere. Mm-hmm. Now I'm just going to share the whole desktop and find, there we are. And if you go down here, then looking under week one, you will see the who are you here, and you can go study that in more detail. We're not going to do that right now. just to have an idea, let me ask out and get rid of this chat so I can see. How many of you have an idea, just an idea, nothing firm, who you would like to collaborate with in this course? Yeah. I see a few, and here it's perfectly good to write no, because that makes it a lot clearer. Who are the no's? I'm almost inclined. And I think, assuming you can all see who's in the course, perhaps it's time to note, you know, who I'm just writing down. And all right, cool. Well, all of those who said no or didn't say anything, please go look at this. And even if you're the type of person who says, look, I work alone best, make sure you have people that you can write when nothing works. And you at least want to see others maybe well-argued and documented code, or maybe not, for inspiration. And don't hold back in sharing code back and forth. All right, I'm going to go to the course introduction now and run through it quickly. I know that you will tire from listening to me at all times. Yeah. Okay, so here we are. It's the five of us, and on the course webpage, you will find us with both emails and phone numbers. So don't hesitate in writing. Now, these are extraordinary times, as I said, and that calls for extraordinary measures. We will, at least to begin with, run the course entirely online. And, well, this you know. Now, this will require both self-discipline and dedication to the coursework from your side. So please already mentally gear up for that. We will do our best to inspire and help and promote collaboration, but it is up to you, it's always up to you, but now more than normally, how much you want to learn and benefit from this course. And coursework can and should be done in collaboration with fellow students. So please make those small teams. I can't say it enough. All right. Now, I hope and trust that we will, in some form, perhaps return to actually having a lecture hall and a place for exercises and so on. But even if we do, we will continue to make the course available to those who might not, for other reasons, be able to access it, just so that you know. Never mind where the lectures will be going on. Here are our offices. Never mind that. Computer and software, well, as I said, we will be coding in Python, and I would highly recommend it, but the choice is yours. And we might provide code examples or code snippets, and those will be in Python. You can write in pure Python. I mostly do that. I call it pure Python. Or you can write in Jupyter Notebooks. And they're also pretty good, as long as the projects don't get too large. You can run it either on Erda or on your own laptop. And I think, well, first of all, those who don't know, Erda is the central login for scientific computing at science faculty. You have an account because you have a KU ID. And in there, you can run things also on multiple cores. So for big jobs, it might be good. And also, all the packages are installed there. Maybe, Carl, you can remind me, when you log on to Erda, which type of session do you choose in order to have all these ready?
The TensorFlow notebook have all of them except LightBGM at the moment.
Okay. And either you can install LightGBM, thanks, Carl, either you can install that yourself, or we will get it centrally installed. That was actually the plan, but it didn't happen yet. And we also recommend that you use GitHub. We will use it more than currently. And I think it's one of those tools that you know, even industry looks at your CV if you know GitHub, because it's sort of a thing showing if you actually code a lot. And we will provide data in all sorts of different formats. If the format is too weird, then we'll of course also provide something to read it with. But yeah, and we have some Python packages, which I already showed. Projects and exam. So there's a small project and final project. And yeah, we already went through those. So have a look at it and read through, and again, discuss with a peer or two about if you want to form a group or just what you plan to do. The book, we went through that, and the recognition that Ian Goodfellow wrote a good part five, part one, chapter five. Expectations. Yeah, I expect this course to be useful to all of you. And so if for some reason it isn't, write back. And feedback, well, the earlier the better. And you're welcome to add or suggest, criticize, or also or so on. But it is a very independent course in the sense that much of what goes on is up to you. So consider this, to some extent, rather a project than a course. It's a project where we all gather to sort of hear something generally about machine learning, and then after that, working on a project to use it. And the aim is, of course, to make you knowledgeable about the basics of machine learning and be able to apply it to suitable data. And that's about it. If you have problems, maybe in relation to the course or maybe for other reasons, and whatever the origin, write us. Maybe we can't do anything about it, but mostly we're willing to battle on your behalf, and if we don't know about them, we can't do anything about them. All right, that's about it. We consider ourselves fairly large, as long as it's met by sincerity and will, but it's your responsibility to write us. And then that's about it. Yeah. All right. Any questions at this time? I will go down here and say, does Jupyter already have the necessary packages installed? No. Adat doesn't. No, it doesn't have the Light GBM, but you can install them via terminal. That's right. That works nicely. Are these slides uploaded? Yes, they are. They are on the very front of the course webpage, just below the when, where, what prerequisites, and so on. This is where the information is, and this is where the questionnaire is. All right. That was also answered. Do we have access to cluster time to run jobs on GPUs? That is a very good question. We hope so. So far, we do have some GPUs, but it might be hard to do an exercise where everybody is running on a GPU. So it might be that we take an example job or what we do. We haven't finalized that yet. And again, it's, you know, sometimes Brian gets these, do you want to use our GPUs from some commercial provider? And then it comes with some strings attached. And then the answer was first yes, and then no, and maybe, and so on. We hope to have that, but I can't promise it. And to those who are thinking, why is he asking about GPUs? That's because many, not all, but most machine learning algorithms are computationally heavy and well suited for GPUs, which are the graphical processor units in computers, which simply allows a speed up. And especially for image analysis with convolutional neural networks, for example, they really speed up things by up to a factor 100. So now where are you supposed to contact us? I'm gonna share screen again for the course webpage. At the very start of the course webpage is all of us and all our phone numbers and all our emails. And that should be enough to contact us, at least one of us. Yeah. Do you use Epsilon Canvas for anything in this course? Yes, for writing the link to the course webpage that we use and for writing out to you because the interface to the list of students is good. And then finally, we use the exam for submitting the exam presentation. But as this is done in groups, we're not exactly certain how that's going to turn out, but we'll come back on that. Yeah. Any other questions? And if you have, don't hesitate to unmute because it's getting awfully lonely here in the sound space of this meeting. Rasmus, could you ask that question out? Unmute and just break the monotony here.
Yeah, sure. I just want to know if it's okay to use Google Colab instead of Ava.
That's perfectly all right. In this course, you're welcome to do whatever you want. If it's a wooden frame you calculate on, that's perfectly fine as well. Anything is allowed. And Sven asked if he had a microphone, he would probably be asking here the most. All right, Sven, well, you know what to get. You can write your questions in general. Okay. If there are no other questions, then I'm going to go back to sharing on the course webpage and talk about what are we going to do today in the first week. So we go into week one. And I think we should have a 15-minute break. And then I'm going to give, this took much longer than anticipated, but I knew that it was going to take longer than 20 minutes or so. I'm going to give a short talk on an overview of machine learning techniques. And then we're going to dive into the exercises. And for the exercise here, we simply put data. There are two data sets here. And you can start with version 0 here. And then there's a small README file about what the hell is this. And here's a description and the variables and the target. And it's simulated data. Which means that we actually know what the origin of this was. So now it's about getting an algorithm to guess it. But to begin with, I want you to be the algorithm. I want you to plot the different variables and ask yourself, you know, can I see the difference? Plot it for those who are B quarks and those who are not. So this could, I could have said that this data comes from a hospital that had a lot of patients and some were ill and some were not, and we know, and here are some of the features of it, and now you need to tell if the next person is ill or not. And just to look at the distributions and ask if you can, with if questions, simply divide this into two, seeing how well you can do that. What fraction do you get right? What fraction do you get wrong? So, but first I'm going to give a short overview talk on machine learning techniques. Should we just have 5 minutes where we stretch our legs and relax mentally? I think so. That was a rhetorical question. So we're going to have that. And so we'll start at 4 o'clock sharp on a little machine learning methods overview. Enjoy meanwhile. Already 1 minute past. Sorry about that. Let's go to a talk about machine learning, and it is posted on week one. So you can download it from there, but I'll also be sharing it here. Share. Here we go. I hope everybody can see the slides, and if you can't, then don't hesitate to unmute and complain, because then you're probably not the only one. So this is a quick introduction to multivariate analysis, which means data that has a lot of variables. And well, humans are good at seeing complex features in low dimensions. The problem arises when we go to high dimensions, and the little table below shows what we're good at. So if things are in low dimensions, and here we're talking, you know, 1, 2, or maybe 3, then if things are linear, then humans are very good at it, and so are computers, because that's an analytic problem and we can solve that. If it's non-linear, then humans are still good. It doesn't matter what strange shape it has, our eyes are trained at seeing that. For computers, it actually gets hard, because now it's no longer an analytical problem and the large machinery has to be started. In high dimensions, we're dead. Humans cannot see things. It's simply lost on them. Whereas for high dimensions, linear problems, computers do all right. Because, well, analytically you can solve it, and then, well, here you go. In high dimensions for things that are non-linear, we're of course still dead. Computers used to be dead as well. They couldn't come out with solutions, but this has changed with the revolution of machine learning, I would say. This is where data that was previously considered dark data, you know, we have no clue, we have no way of analyzing it. This has changed. And so that has been the game changer. And so that's typically where we want to go. And what do we mean by high dimensions? Well, if you tell even a trained person, let's say a doctor, this person, you know, both the medical record of the person, which might be very complex, how much exercise, smoking, and so on. And here's an image from this, and here's a scan of that, and here's the timeline of a third thing, and here is the genetic code, and here are the history, medical history of parents and children and whatnot. If you gather all of that, the doctor will have a hard time putting together, well, I think you're ill or you're not ill, because these are simply too many pieces of information. But with enough data, computers can learn those patterns and give answers back. So that's what we're aiming at. And so this data mining in general is seeing patterns in data and using it. And this is used, among other places, also in scientific discovery. So there is, well, several subdivisions. There's, well, if we look at machine learning, there are two main classes of things. You can do supervised learning, or you can do unsupervised learning. In supervised learning, you have data where you already know the result you're seeking. And what you're trying to do is to take, actually build a function which takes a lot of inputs and gives out one output, one or a few outputs. And this can further be split into classification or regression. Either you give one output saying ill or not, or, you know, classifying things into two or more categories, typically two, or you're trying regression, where you're trying to give an estimate of a value. That could be the price of a house, that could be the energy of an electron. There are many ways, many things. And so you see around these what it comes to. Go to the other side, the blue side, unsupervised learning. Well, this means that you do not have a guide to what this is. You don't have cases that you already know. That makes things a lot harder. You can do clustering, where you say, well, I don't quite know what this is, but I can see that it is close, and then you have to define what close is to that one. Or you can do dimensionality reduction, where you say, well, I see that the data here exists in a super high dimensionality space. Let me try to at least reduce that. And an example which is the precursor of this is a PCA, principal component analysis, for example. That's dimensionality reduction. And I think the most brutal case I know of this is genetics, DNA, because human DNA at least have 3 billion bases. And that means that if you your DNA as data lives in a 3 billion dimensional space. And that's an incredible space. And just to give you an idea about this, and this is not from the slides, this is just to give you a feel for dimensionality. For example, in the clustering case, let's say that you had a unit ball in 10 dimensions. So it's not a three-dimensional ball, it's a 10-dimensional ball that goes out to one in all directions. Well, you might have 500 points inside that ball, and you say, well, here's a new point. What does that look like? And you might say, look, I'm going to put it to the nearest neighbor. I'm just going to say it's probably like the nearest neighbor. And I have 500, so I should be okay. Well, in a 10-dimensional space, it turns out that the most likely nearest neighbor you have is the wall, the outer wall. The 10-dimensional space, even if it's just a unit ball, is so large that you're more likely to be closest to the edge than you are to any other of the 500 points. Now imagine a 3 billion dimensional space. You're of course lost, but through, for example, a PCA, you can reduce that to as few dimensions as you want. So that's the basic picture of where we are. And we will mostly be on this side in supervised learning. And as you saw for the small project, which is not that small, I warn you, it's not that small, it's just a name. We wanted you to try the three things, namely classification, regression, and unsupervised learning of whatever you like. All right. And then typically when you want to classify things, that's because you want to distinguish between two hypotheses. The person is ill, the person is not. This is an electron, this is not. And those of you who had applied statistics have seen this slide. What I tend to say is that when you see the two overlapping hypotheses, then machine learning, what it typically does is that it enables a better separation between the hypotheses. It is able to provide a more powerful test statistic that separates the two hypotheses better. And that's when it comes to classification. All right, so let's just, simple example. Let's say you want to divide a sample into male and female, but the only thing you have is the height. Well, you might say, well, if you're above 185, then you know, you're probably male. But then it turns out that you also have the shoe size. All right, well, if you have large shoes and you know, you're tall, probably you're male, the other way you're female. But then you plot the two. And what we just did is the leftmost picture. And here you see it's not a very beautiful or efficient way of doing things. Then in the middle picture, you could try something like that, but that's clumsy and hard to implement. Whereas the final approach is a smarter one. You say, we're going to project things onto a direction, and that gives us a much better view of it. And the latter approach, and this is a linear approach, analytic approach, comes from the irises of Fisher. And here's the way it's done. You do a projection. And how can you get the projection direction? Well, you can calculate that analytically from the samples you have. Notice this is supervised learning because you can only calculate these by dividing into sample A and sample B. And then here's from the paper. Never mind, you simply project onto a direction and suddenly you have a good separation. And here's how you calculate, never mind. But if you look at the left picture, that's going to work fine on the left picture, but it's not going to work that well on the right picture, right? Things are more complex. And so, well, here you need tougher methods. So enter machine learning. It's a huge subject, and this course is only going to scratch the surface, but hopefully also whet your appetite. So let's dive in. I would say that there are two main classes of algorithm types. There is neural networks. And neural networks can become very complex. They are often very good for continuous problems. They can be hard to train. So if you look at the network next to me, well, there are three input variables and there are two hidden layers and three output variables. And well, now you ask, what do I have to do there? Well, what you have to do is that you have to adjust the weights of each of the lines so that this works. And you don't know what those weights are. And each line is represented, needs two numbers. So already here, you need to find the right combination of parameters in a high dimensional space. So that's hard, can be done, but maybe not that easy. Neural networks can be in a special configuration used for images, and it easily produces multiple outputs. As you can see here, there are three outputs, and that's perfectly fine and easy. No problem with that. The other school of thought, you could say, is decision trees. They can also become very complex. They're good for discrete problems. Imagine that one of your variables is discrete. It might even be a category. For example, if you're doing something with data where people gave their postal code, right? What to put in the postal code, what to multiply it by. But for a decision tree, that's not hard. And you see here a decision tree, which is a bit morbid, but a quite known example. It's the predicting the survival of the Titanic disaster. And so you can just ask if people live in Hellerup or not and make a small example out of those or not. If you're trying to predict housing prices, for example. It doesn't matter if it's discrete for a tree, but for a neural network, and I'll get more into that in a moment, that's tough. And that means that decision trees are good for, in fact, all problems. If you want the closest thing to an off-the-shelf procedure for getting quick and reasonable results, tree-based methods are good. But they're not always the best in the long run. In fact, to some extent, far from. And there's a whole class of problems that you can't solve with it. For example, images. All right. So let's dive shortly into neural networks. What goes on? Well, at the bottom right is a simple neural network with one hidden layer that has five neurons in. There are four input variables. And again, I think the medical example is typically the one that sort of mentally rings the best. So imagine that you have four measurements about a patient. And for the output, you would like to know either if the person is ill with some disease or not. That would be for classification. Or you're trying to predict the probability that, I don't know, that this person can run a marathon in less than 5 hours or something like that. You're predicting the time it would take for the person to run a marathon, right? You're predicting a value, not between A or B. So regression. You can do both things with the neural network easily. You can also do that with the tree. Now, each line is represented by the f function that goes between 0 and 1. Typically, this activation function could be the function shown up there. As it turns out, this is rarely used simply because that function is too slow. But that's another thing. And so, if you, if input one, if we look at the top hidden layer neuron, the blue top dot, well, then how is that, the value of that calculated? Well, it's calculated as an input of the four other ones run through that function and then summarized. So so that's what you do up here. You summarize each of the four numbers with a weight, and then you put it into this activation function. And then you get a value in the top one, which is typically, you know, did you fire, or did you trigger or not? And the next one does it as well, but in a different way. And the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And then you have five values in the hidden layer. And then you do it again. And here you get the output. But you can, as you saw before, make it arbitrarily complex. And the activation function can be, well, there are many different choices. We'll get to that later. In the decision tree, what are you trying to do here? Well, you're trying to ask a question and subdivide things into boxes. And here's the example from before where you say, look, this is a great way of doing it. Because the problem before, which linearly could not be solved, well, suddenly there is a solution for that. You ask first if x1 is greater or less than a, then you ask x2, and then you might ask x1 again, and so on. And this works for most problems. And it works fine for nonlinear problems like this one. Yeah, so there you go. And then boosting is something that was invented because you make a tree and you think that's good, but well, how about focusing on those you got wrong? How do you do that? Well, you do it by changing the weight of those who were wrong. So you run one time, build a tree, and then you ask those you got wrong, give them an increased weight, you boost the weight, and then do it again. And then you build a new tree. You don't throw away the other one, you just build a new tree. And at the end, you let all your trees vote. And in this way, you get a more powerful algorithm than just a single decision tree. And then you want to test if you're overtraining. And this, there are two types of overtraining. It might be that, well, you train on some data and then you apply it to another set of data, the testing data, and then the two do not come with the same distribution. And the example shown here is where blue is signal and red is background, you're trying to divide something up, and you see that signal and background each by themselves are actually well represented by the training, by the testing sample. Well, as it turns out, they don't have to be that way. It's not a sin to do a little or weak overtraining as long as you know that your test sample will not follow that path. The greater view is on the next slide. So here is an example where you on the x-axis, you have the complexity of your algorithm. To some extent, you can say how much you trained it, how big you built it. And on the y-axis, we have the performance. And in red is your training set, and in blue is your validation set. And it says CV, and that's cross-validation. We'll get back to what that is. To begin with, as you just go a little up in complexity, suddenly the improvement is great. And the improvement is great in both the training set and the validation set. So the validation set is what it has never seen before. Then it starts recognizing a few things in the training sets which do not exist in the validation set. And that's okay. Some overtraining is good because things still improve in the validation set. But at some point, it doesn't improve anymore. And in fact, even if the training error keeps going down, and in the end, with an infinity of trees, you can of course get a perfect score, a perfect classification on the training set, but it does not show up in the validation data set. In fact, as you can see maybe slightly, it starts rising again. What? Well, that's because at some point, all you're seeing are the statistical fluctuations in your training set, which do not exist at all in the validation set. And so it actually goes up a bit. So yeah, that's the state of it. So your option, and we'll get back to how you do that, is to get a complex but not too complex algorithm. What methods are good or bad? And here it's more that I want you to think on how you evaluate them than actually looking at what they can do. So here, the criteria. Well, performance is a good criteria, right? If there are no only linear correlations, well, then the Fisher does perfectly well because it deals with linear correlation. Whereas the neural network will do well as well, and so will the BDT. That's a simple problem. If there are nonlinear correlations, the Fisher will not do well. Most likely not. The neural network and the BDT will do as fine. Speed. How fast is it training it? And here I don't like what's in the table. I should probably rewrite it. The Fisher is, of course, immediate to train. Train takes a long time, and I would say in particular for neural networks. The response time is usually fast for all of them. Typically, you can make 10,000 predictions a second. So you have to, you know, you can predict on a lot of data fast. Now, robustness, how robust is it to overtraining or weak variables? And by weak variables, it might be a variable that gives little or no additional information. You know, then it might be cheated by that. Well, for overtraining, the trees can run into troubles. And for weak variables, the neural network can run into troubles. Curse of dimensionality. How does it fare if there is 1,000 variables, 1,000 dimensions in the problem? Well, the Fisher is fine. The other two are okay. Finally, transparency. And here, the Fisher, you can write up the Fisher formula, so that's transparent. For the two others, machine learning has in general been accused of being a black box. You cannot know why it gave the prediction it did. Just have a little tea. But this has actually changed a little bit, and there are ways to get knowledge of how you can get information about that. We'll return to that. All right. How do we compare methods? Well, typically we do that with a ROC curve. Here you just see a comparison of methods. And it's on the data set on the left. Separate the blue and the red. This is certainly not linear. The Fisher, the blue curve fails, completely follows the diagonal. Whereas, you know, a whole host of methods will get way into the corner as well as you can. And finally, what method to use? And I don't want you to follow this plan. Again, this is more conceptual, but I thought it was fun that people actually made a cheat sheet for scikit-learn, which is one of the packages that contains a lot of different methods in machine learning. I wouldn't say it's the most powerful one, but it's actually a very good and very well-documented package that gets you started fast. So it says, well, do you have 50 or not? And if you don't, then get more data. And then we get into the, are you predicting a category? Are we in categorization or are we in regression? If we're categorizing, then it asks, do you have labeled data? Meaning, you know, is this supervised or not? Are there labels on your data saying he was ill, she was not, and so on? Or is there not? If the answer is yes, then you're in the classification problem. And then there are different ways of doing that. If the answer is no, you're in the clustering. Because now you would say, I don't have labels, but I'm trying to find those who are alike. Back to predicting a category. If you're not predicting a category, you're probably predicting a quantity. If you are, you're in regression. There are the methods, and you go with those. If you're not looking at a quantification, then you might be just looking. And this is where the dimensionality reduction comes in. And then if you're not just looking, well, good luck. And if you don't have 10,000 events of something, then clustering is probably not going to work very well. So, yeah, some problems are simply not fit for machine learning at all. And maybe the problem is that you don't have labeled data enough. So this is one of the first things to think about. But now I'm going to jump out and stop sharing.
I think there's a question.
Cool. Fire up. That was exactly it.
I know. I mean, in the chat, there's a question.
Okay. We're going to go to those now. Do you have one yourself or?
No, I just wanted to point it out.
Okay, cool. Where to start? I'm a collector of special hats. All right, yeah, well, let's kill that. That's from my grandfather, First and Second World War hats, and they don't fit at home, and I spend a lot of time in the office, so that's why I have them hanging for decoration. Yes, regarding overtraining, is it a problem if the validation loss is constant and does not rise when increasing the complexity? All right, so thanks for that question. We'll go back to the slides, and I'll go back to this very important slide. I should say that, remember, this is a graph that you don't have until you've trained a lot. So you don't know what complexity here, the number of leaf nodes, is suitable for your problem until you tried each and every number way beyond the optimal. And the question is, what if it doesn't rise? Is it then a problem that you use a highly complex algorithm? In principle, no. In practice, yes. Well, if it does as well on the validation sample, that's fine. But it becomes computationally heavy, meaning that it will be slower. And worse yet, it becomes large. It might be taking up quite significant parts of your memory to have the model in memory. So if you go from, I don't know, 35 leaf nodes to 350, and you didn't improve, but you made things 10 times bigger and more cumbersome and complex, then, well, that's not worthwhile. Also, the training time would be longer. So actually, as always in science, it's about getting the simplest thing that will work well. I hope that answers the question. Otherwise, don't hesitate to come back. Yeah. Where do we find suitable data for our projects? Yes, I will share screen, but this time it will be the web page. Well, where do you find that? In the final project page, which I have here, we have listed some data sets that we have. And you may use those, that's perfectly fine, or you may want to go look at your own. Maybe it's a bad word saying backup data sets, because some of them are at the forefront of research. So it's more meant as a backup if you don't have anything particularly you want to work on and rather have some of these. A word of warning, it's not that easy to find large amounts of data. But I was inspired yesterday by somebody who said, look, we took an English and a Danish dictionary, and then we trained on that to see if the machine algorithm could take a new word and predict if this was a Danish or an English word. Smart, fun. Yeah, sky's the limit. All right, back to the chat. No more questions. Well, don't hesitate in coming with a question. But then I think we should jump to the exercise.
I have a question.
Yeah, come on,
Simon. Question regarding the decision trees. Do you yourself make the branches in the decision trees and then allow the algorithm to find the weight for each decision, or does the algorithm create the decision trees and then find the weights for each decision?
The algorithm does everything. The only thing it doesn't do is that we'll get to this, but let me answer partially now. This will be a general thing. The algorithm will say, how much can I divide? And you might say, look, you shouldn't ask more than, I don't know, 4 questions. This relates to the depth of the tree. It might also be you say, you may ask as many questions you like, but I don't want you to subdivide into a group that has less than, I don't know, 20 entries in. So then depending on data size, there's a natural limit for how much you can ask. Or it might be that it says, you can only go ask 2 questions, but I'll make a lot of trees. And these are the so-called hyperparameters. Right? They're not the parameters because they're not the weights in the neural network and they're not the value at which you cut in the tree, but they're sort of the numbers defining the architecture. And knowing which ones are the best is a problem, and we'll hear about that on next Wednesday, so in 9 days. But no, this is done automatically, and you read the papers about how it's done, typically in smart and fast ways. I hope that answered your question.
Yes, it did. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Then let's go to the exercise of today and the data of today. So we go back into week 1. And so down here, you will see that today is just inspecting data, making a human decision tree for classification. Never mind what it is. Here's a description of what it is. And so you have input variables. There is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 input variables. You are not forced to use all of them, but 10 is a small number, so that should be fine. And then you have a target value. Usually these are called X, and the target value is typically called Y. So it's 1 if it's a B quark and 0 if it's not. And now you want to divide your data so that you say, all right, I use some fraction for training, and then afterwards I see how well I'm doing on a validation data set. And then you might say, do I train and test? Well, what's this validation? Often people put aside a test data set, which they don't look at all until they're completely done with the algorithm. But for each step or for each set of hyperparameters or whatever, you want to see, am I doing better or worse? And this you evaluate on a validation data set. All right. So the goal is to identify B quarks, but to begin with, I just want you to try to read this data set and see, so take the version 0 and see if the data set makes sense. If there's anything nasty in it where you say, this is strange, this is weird, something went wrong, or some variables are missing, or do I understand the distributions, and do I see a difference between signal or background? So for example, just try to plot the prop B variable for those who are B quarks and for those who aren't in the same plot. Just to see, you know, is there a difference between the two? Should I even expect this to ever work? And try to write if sentences to divide it and then ask afterwards, okay, how many did I get right and how many did I get wrong? And well, if you get less than 50% right, then probably you're very unlucky and doing something wrong or turned the sign around. But you will never get 100% right, whatever you do. There isn't enough information for that. Okay. Any questions to the exercise? And we'll keep this channel running, so it's not like it's your last chance. But if you have a question, please come forth. Others will have it. No? Well, the exercise is now both what I just said, but also try to do it with someone else. Maybe random, maybe not, if you know somebody, but try to team up at least two, maybe more, and just discuss, you know, code for reading it, code for plotting it, and so on. Hopefully this should not take you too long. And I can say that by the end of the exercise on Wednesday, we will come with example solutions for this one, just to get started. And no, you shouldn't submit the exercise anywhere. This is just for you to see how well you can do it, get things started. And I can tell you that we will be working on this data again on Wednesday, where we will be applying machine learning algorithms to it once we've gone through those more. And if you feel like starting on a machine learning algorithm for this right now, you're more than welcome. But I would like you to start by checking the data, seeing if it makes sense, and seeing which variables you think are going to be good and which you don't think are going to do anything. Okay? All right. And with that, I'll stop recording and we'll go into exercise mode.